It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. February 12th is the 207th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution. Over the last couple of decades, there's been a movement afoot to establish an International Darwin Day that would be celebrated around the world, and the movement is growing. There are groups all over the world that have been organizing annual Darwin Day celebrations. One of those groups is in Iowa City, where Darwin Day will be celebrated February 18th through the 20th this year with a series of conversations about topics in science and evolution. And we're taking this opportunity to talk about teaching science, including evolution. We'll talk about science literacy and the language we use when we talk about science. Later in the hour, we'll also get some insight into recent research on human evolution and have some conversations with people who'll be speaking at this year's Darwin Day celebrations. And my first guest today is Emily Scherning. She is Director of Research for the National Center for Science Education. She'll also be part of the Darwin Day celebration. We'll talk more about her role in that in a few minutes. Emily, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Charity.
And you came to Iowa in 2011. Since you came to Iowa, you have spent a lot of time visiting school districts in the state of Iowa. What is your goal when you visit a school district?
So I spent a lot of time working with school districts from 2011 to 2014, helping teachers learn how to teach science better. I would do professional development workshops, and then I would visit them in the classroom to help do sort of just-in-time teaching, and sometimes just to support teachers when they needed an extra hand. Now that I work for the National Center for Science Education, I'm usually visiting teachers when they've been the recipient of grants from us so that I can see how they want to use the equipment we've been able to get them in their classroom and see how that's going to impact their students.
Now, we hear a lot about STEM education in Iowa and around the country, science, technology, engineering, and math. And there's a lot of focus on making sure that science is taught in schools. What do you feel the greatest challenges are for the teachers that you've interacted with over the years in trying to implement a science curriculum?
You know, as I'm reaching out to teachers over the last 10 months in Iowa, as I've started working for NCSE, it seems like the biggest problem teachers have is materials cost. As we move towards a more hands-on, more inquiry-based way of teaching science, and as we move towards teaching engineering in the K through 12 classroom, which is a real innovation, a wonderful innovation, teachers need a lot of materials flexibility, and that's just not part of the traditional funding model in public schools. I talk to teachers every week. I meet a new teacher who tells me that they're spending some extraordinary amount of money on supplies out of pocket. Because we have very passionate, very dedicated, very educated teachers in Iowa, and they need support to have the best quality of education they can for their students. They need material support and emotional support from communities.
Well, and in teaching science, I mean, research has shown us that if you can show your students how something works as opposed to just telling them how something works, it's a lot more effective, right? So I can imagine that there's a lot of pressure on the teachers to come up with ways to demonstrate that in the classroom.
Oh, and the NGSS really calls for engagement in scientific practice, having students engage in the scientific method. And if you're going to have students do that, I think that that's very challenging to do with even a traditional lab experience where everyone knows what the outcome is supposed to be and there's a lot of anxiety for students. Are they going to get the right answer? You want opportunities for students to be able to ask questions and answer them. And for teachers to enable that in their classrooms, they need to have flexibility. They need a lot of flexibility to find ways to help their students answer their questions using the scientific method.
Now, of course, there are lots of different subjects that can be taught in science classes. And today we're talking quite a lot about evolution. And you have a statistic that I find really shocking, that 60% of teachers nationally avoid the topic of evolution in their classrooms?
We have found that it's 60% of teachers avoid teaching evolution. Roughly 20% do spend time teaching about evolution, and about 20% openly teach creationism or other intelligent design type variants. We're really interested in finding ways to reach that 60% of teachers who don't teach evolution for a variety of reasons, sometimes because they're worried about community support for an idea that in some areas is still seen as controversial. Sometimes I think that teachers feel that they don't have adequate preparation. But the most common response that we get from teachers is that they don't feel supported by communities and they don't want to cause any problems for themselves.
So the fear of having an objection.
Yes, even more so than actually having had objections, the fear of having objections and the amount of time and emotional energy that that will consume when they're already such a stressed profession, when they're already really quite overtaxed, American teachers.
In your work, you've visited every rural school district within an hour of Iowa City. So that's a segment of
just about everyone.
Okay, just about everyone.
Yeah.
That's a segment of the state of Iowa. And of course, there's a lot of diversity between the towns, the cities, and the more rural districts. So in doing that kind of research and visiting all of these school districts, what have you learned about different feelings about the theory of evolution in Iowa?
Well, you know, I've found that it is very interesting. It's very heavily dependent on the community. You get into some communities that are quite rural, and the teachers will be very openly accepting of this. There will be a strong community response in favor of teaching evolution. And in areas that are quite remote, in areas where you wouldn't necessarily stereotypically expect a positive response. But I have to admit that by and large, both in cities and in smaller towns and in rural areas, there's a distinct hesitancy in talking about evolution. And oftentimes I would have experiences where I would be embedded in a school district, embedded in a classroom. And after 8 or 9 months, a teacher would tell me, you know, we don't actually teach this stuff. Well, we're not going to work on this curriculum anymore because I can't actually teach this in my classroom. And that was very sad for me, that because of this fear of controversy, we're not giving American students in public schools the opportunities that they need to be able to compete in the STEM economy.
You have focused a lot on the language that we use when we talk about science, when we talk about evolution. Where does that figure in? What is important about the words that we use in this subject matter?
So a lot of my research before I transitioned into the nonprofit world with NCSE was about the impact of language on teaching science. And I found that the types of words that we use, the scientific vocabulary that we use, has a huge impact on people's ability to learn science, that many people are frightened, to their lack of a better word, by the specialized vocabulary of science, that they feel overwhelmed, that they have such defensive reactions that they kind of shut down. I think a lot of scientific topics, we can clearly explain the concept using everyday language. And that if we do that, if we work to make science accessible without dumbing down the concepts at all, we can reach more people, we can make them feel more comfortable. And my goal in this is to try and help more people find that science is fun. I find science to be enormously fun. I love working with science, and I want to be able to share that excitement with people. I think that using accessible language is an important part of that.
You have noted that it's not just evolution that is a problematic subject for a lot of science teachers around the country. There are a few different areas in science that many teachers kind of avoid because they're worried about controversy, or maybe for other reasons as well. Evolution is one of them. Climate change is another.
Yes, and the climate change problem is interesting. You know, in American culture, we have a real interest in fairness. We have an interest in promoting debates. And so we actually find that many schools do teach climate change to some extent, but they often teach it in a social studies class, in a debate context, when that does not accurately reflect the scientific consensus about climate change. Climate change should be taught in the science class, and kids should get to learn the scientific consensus information about it.
Another area of scientific knowledge that some teachers avoid is geologic time. Tell me about this issue.
This is an increasing problem that I think is just starting to hit the radar, in that there are some people who are influencing school districts to not teach topics in a way that would be contrary to the beliefs of young earth creationists. And when you see people who don't want geologic time being mentioned in the context of geology classes, like the age of rocks, and I've heard some complaints about this related to astronomy, related to the age of the universe. I would go ballistic if I found out that my kids weren't being taught accurate information about our best consensus information about geologic time and the age of the universe. And I think that that's not a controversial point for most people. We shouldn't be so afraid of offending a tiny percentage of the population that we can't teach consensus science in science class.
Now, and I understand we're bringing in two different parts of your career and your life, trying to bring them both together. Is that something you've encountered in Iowa?
The geologic time issue?
Yeah.
I did encounter that in one school district in Iowa where a young teacher who I thought was just such an excellent teacher. She did a wonderful job leading her very young students, third grade students, through the scientific method. She told me she was very upset that she had had pressure not to teach a unit on erosion because one family had complained that this might bring up geologic time. I think that that is very sad if erosion is treated as a gateway drug in our public school system. Erosion should not be a controversial topic.
Well, and in that case, where was the pressure coming from? Was it from within her school, the principal or the community concerned that this was going to blow up into a controversy?
They were concerned it was going to blow up. They had had complaints from one family, and so none of the kids were going to learn about erosion because there were complaints from one family.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest right now is Emily Scherning. She is Director of Research for the National Center for Science Education. She lives in Iowa City. She will be part of the Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City coming up February 18th through the 20th. On Saturday the 20th, she'll be giving a workshop from 2 to 5 for teachers and educators and other interested people who want to be a part of that as well. And Emily, yeah.
Family members or your friends. It's
right,
also good for the everyday citizen.
All right. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We'll also bring a science teacher into the conversation here in a second as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Science is real. Science is real.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about science education. We're talking about teaching evolution in the classroom, science literacy. We're also getting a preview of Darwin Day, which will be celebrated in Iowa City February 18th through the 20th. And right now, we are focusing on science education in the classroom. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions or experiences you'd like to share. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me is Emily Scherning. She is Director of Research for the National Center for Science Education. And also Dawn Posacani is here. She's a science teacher at Solon High School. She teaches biology, anatomy, zoology, microbiology, and botany. So has a lot of experience teaching scientific subjects. Dawn, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. This is such a treat.
Well, and you were just listening to the conversation I was having with Emily about some of the challenges that science teachers face. And I think I just pointed out one of the biggest challenges that a science teacher faces by talking about the variety of classes that you teach. I mean, that's a huge array of scientific knowledge that you need to have command of in your teaching. How do you cope with that?
It's a challenge, you know, and that's very common in our great state of Iowa here. We have a lot of teachers, and especially brand new teachers, that enter these school districts, and they have five different science classes they prep for the day. And that is a challenge. And they're not perfect. It's not always pretty, but we do the best we can. And luckily, we get that educational preparation that helps us with that. We rely on our experiences. We rely on our colleagues, both current and the ones we've had in the past, and keep moving forward.
Well, and we were talking earlier about trying to make science come to life for students. When you're teaching that many different classes, that must be an incredible challenge as well, to be able to come up with, and I realize you have curricula, but to be able to come up with ideas to be able to present to your students so many different subjects.
Yeah, you really have to rely, again, on others to a great extent. And something that I've found that really has helped me is really getting out in the community to rely on these business partners, to develop relationships with businesses that they can come in. They can help with equipment if necessary. They can provide some additional expertise. They can allow for kids to job shadow. We can go and do tours at a facility. There's just so many things that really are out there that as teachers, then we have to really reach out and try and find those opportunities for our students.
Now, focusing for just a few minutes on evolution, I want to return to that statistic that I was talking about with Emily. 60% of teachers nationally avoid the topic of evolution. And she was talking about how a lot of teachers are avoiding the topic of evolution because they are concerned about having objections or they've encountered objections in the past. Do you think that there are other factors that might lead teachers to avoid teaching evolution in the classroom?
Yeah, I do. I think even for me, initially when I was out of college, I don't know that I had the best preparation in evolution. It was minimal. You know, even at the college level for me, I don't know that I got, you know, a full understanding of what evolution was all about. Certainly, we've come a long ways in our understanding since then. But I was not confident. And I think there are other teachers out there that feel the same way, that when it's a controversial topic and you feel uncertain in your own understanding, that's going to lead you to hesitate in that case.
Yeah, Emily?
You know, that's something that we're really trying to help right now with NCSE. There's that workshop that I'm teaching in person in Iowa City, but we have an online component to this where teachers can take the online course and we're going to have it recorded and hosted so they can really see it at their leisure, that will teach about ways to talk about evolution to decrease controversy in your classroom. It'll talk about common misconceptions about the scientific method and common misconceptions about evolutionary theory. So teachers who want to tune in on their own time, they should check out NCSE.com. We're going to be hosting those lectures starting towards the end of the month.
So that gives teachers a great opportunity. I think with evolution, though, just from my own educational experience and from trying to talk with my kids about it, I feel like there's an incredibly simplistic way to teach evolution. And I think that there are several far more complicated ways to teach evolution. And when you try to simplify it, I think there are lots and lots of pitfalls. At least that's what I've run into with my kids. Is that a problem in the classroom, Dawn?
It can be. I think one of the things that I've taken away through my experience is that, you know, when we're going through evolution as a unit of study, we go through it just like we do any other unit. You know, setting it aside or identifying it as special, unique, or different in some way as content, I think is a mistake that teachers can make. And so when we just carry on business as usual, that's effective. We're still looking at data. We're still collecting data. We're still making claims, using evidence to support those claims. When we change that perspective and step away from that scientific view of working like a scientist would work, thinking like a scientist would work, that's where you really run into, I think, the problems and the challenges.
Have you ever run into an objector?
Only a few. So I guess I feel lucky in that way. But mostly it's just curiosity, you know, a parent or a student that's curious, like a parent might say, what do you teach about evolution and how do you go about that? And so just having a conversation with them is, for me, has been successful. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we go about that. And helping them really understand that, again, we're not doing things different. It's about the process and nature of science and not about a particular viewpoint in the evolutionary theory or anything like that.
What have you found in your classroom that you feel makes evolution come to life for your students?
I think they're just genuinely curious. And part of that, I think, is because it's controversial. You know, I found just in teaching anything, when you can add a little bit of controversy to it, you know, it engages the kids more, whether it's genetically modified organisms or vaccines or evolution in this case. You know, they want to know about those things. They want to grapple with it and think about it and make their own ideas from that. And that really gets them involved. And then that desire to understand really helps out.
Now, Emily, that brings up an interesting subject, because a lot of teachers, in grappling with the controversy about evolution, will bring in the alternate theories. And they'll talk, as you mentioned, about intelligent design or about creationism in the classroom. Do you feel that teachers need to give their students an overview and say, you know, here's what we're talking about with scientific method, but here are the other things that people believe and think about this?
I think that's a fine line to walk. I think that in the science classroom, you should be teaching science, and that it's been repeatedly legally proven that intelligent design and creationism are not topics that belong in the science classroom. I have no problem with people's beliefs. What I care about is the quality of science education in the public schools.
How about you, Don? What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. It is a fine line. And I guess from my perspective, when I have maybe a parent say, "Why don't you teach creationism?" my response is, "That's not my formal educational training. I am not trained to do that. That's the role of your priest or your religious leader to talk about that stuff. My job is really to, from the scientific perspective."
We're talking about science education this hour. With me, Don Posacani, who is a science teacher at Solon High School. And I've been told through Twitter that Solon High School is listening right now. Also with me, Emily Scherning is Director of Research for the National Center for Science Education. You are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have a question from Cindy in Ames. She says, "Is there any public pressure not to teach science related to water quality? Because water quality is a hot topic in Iowa." Have you encountered that at all, Emily?
You know, I hang out with the Iowa City Climate Advocates group. Hopefully I've gotten their name right. And they have started talking a lot about these problems with public water quality, and they're concerned that these aren't being educational issues that are addressed in the schools. I don't know that it's a question of pressure. I think in this case, it may just be that there's already so much in the curriculum. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much content that's expected of teachers at all levels, frankly, you know, whether it's elementary, middle school, or high school, that it's hard to pick and choose, definitely. You know, I think the best we can do as science educators is really focus on the process and the nature of science so that our kids will be able to apply that understanding of how science works and operates to any topic when they are faced with, you know, things in the media, in the news, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot to be pushed in.
I completely agree with you that the method is what we want kids to get. I mean, we live in an era where we have such great access to information, even peer-reviewed information. If you know where to look for it, you don't have to just look at, you know, random high-quality internet sources. And we're going to continue coming across new problems. We're going to continue finding new content areas that people need to explore and make informed decisions about. I think if we can help people learn about the scientific method, we can empower them to make informed decisions in their lives.
Well, and Don, I'm curious about the opinions that your students come into the classroom with, because, you know, we do have in our culture more and more polarization on topics. And Emily was talking earlier about how we sometimes move away from the science and instead focus on the opinion when we cover subjects like climate change in the news media. Do your students come into the classroom having heard things from their parents, heard things on the radio, seen things on television, and bring that to the scientific curriculum.
Sometimes. I don't get that a lot, or at least they don't initially express that. And I think that may be just a product of our program in that, you know, we really focus on all of our classes, not just in my class, but in all of our science classes, looking at the data, being objective to begin with, and really using that evidence, whatever that may be, to form our claims and being able to do that. So I don't know if that's true, but that's what seems to happen. They don't necessarily come forward and say it right away anyway. We do have that fear in our students of they don't want to be wrong. And so also letting them know and giving them these opportunities to talk about these issues, to say these problems, they're real issues, you know, in climate change, in water quality, et cetera, are messy and complex. And there's not a one right, correct, you know, easy solution to some of the problems we have in society and within our environment.
Now, earlier we were talking about some of the other challenges that science teachers face and challenges that you work hard to help them with, Emily. But let's talk about in your classroom. We already talked about how many different subjects you're teaching and how difficult it is to come up with ways to engage your students. Do you find yourself spending a lot of money out of pocket to bring different things into your classroom?
I can only laugh because my husband is probably rolling his eyes right now. Yes. And I think that's, you know, part of that is definitely a personal choice. I am much rather go to the grocery store at the last minute uptown and buy vinegar so that we can do this cool thing where the kids are doing the work rather than me stand up there and say, well, this is how enzymes work. So, yeah, I don't hesitate to use my personal money so that it can be a better experience to develop true understanding with our students. That's just where my personal philosophy is.
And I know a lot of teachers deal with that across all curriculums and all age levels. Do you feel like it's a particular pressure in science?
I think it might be. I guess I haven't really thought about it that way. But yeah, I think it might be because we want what's best for our kids and we're just going to take that and roll. And, you know, the nature of science as it is we might get into this conversation and tomorrow we need the supplies and just how budgeting works. We can't have that purchase order the next day to go get those materials either. So, you know, like having a little account uptown or something is a little bit difficult as far as that goes.
All right. I want to get to the phones. Sharon is on the line in Johnston. Hi, Sharon. Oh, Sharon, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I am a retired teacher, and I just wanted to bring up two points that I've been concerned with. The use of the term local control, which has been bandied about from our legislators and national leaders. And I feel that these are code words for saying that they do not want certain things in the curriculum. And I feel that that's probably going to be evolution and creationism maybe being included and evolution not being, or both, whatever. And then my second point is that the rewriting of textbooks that have been reported happening in Texas, where most of the textbooks are published, and they're rewriting history so that's not what it really was as history, or any of the curriculum that they don't like, they put it into the textbooks, and then different school districts all over the country are having to buy these textbooks because nobody else publishes them. So I'm concerned on both fronts.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for sharing your concerns. And Emily, I'm going to let you respond first to local control with the National Center for Science Education. Is that an issue that you've encountered?
You know, I've only just started to hear the local control term, Sharon, and I think you're right to be concerned. I would share your concern about that. I think a lot of people don't know that there is legal protection for teachers who want to teach science in the science classroom, that there are well-established legal precedents. I think that a lot of people who run into problems with this local control stuff over controversial, potentially controversial issues. They don't know that if they talk about it, that if they speak up, they can get help.
All right. And textbooks, that's been an issue for a long time.
There has been a lot of controversy in the last year related to history, as our caller brings up in the textbooks.
And we are nearly out of time, but I want to touch in 20 seconds on the workshop that you're doing on Saturday, February 20th. You're giving people a real opportunity to come in and role play, right?
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm only going to lecture for like half an hour. It won't be like a really boring lecture. And then we're going to do three different hands-on segments. We're going to learn about the scientific method in a hands-on fashion, make sure you can use the language. We're going to talk about how to build dialogue, and you will get to encounter people who are role-playing as different types of creationists.
All right.
So you can learn how to deal with the objections.
All right. Emily Scherning, thank you so much. Director of Research for the National Center for Science Education. And Don Posacani, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. What a treat.
Don Posacani is a science teacher at Solon High School. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about science education so far, and we're getting a little preview of Darwin Day, which is coming up in Iowa City. It's an international celebration, but groups all over the world have their local celebrations. Iowa City Darwin Day is being celebrated February 18th through the 20th this year. All the events are free and open to the public. And now we're going to get a preview of some of the people who are going to be part of that celebration, in addition to what we were just talking about a moment ago. With me now is Brianna Pobiner. She's an evolutionary anthropologist. She works with the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and she's giving a couple of talks at Darwin Day. One of them is called Humans Are Still Evolving, Evidence from Diet, Disease, and Diversity. That's on the 19th at 3 p.m. And then on the 20th, in the morning at 9:45, she'll give a talk called What Was the Real Paleo Diet? And she is here with me now. Hello, Brianna.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And now, you study the evolution of the human diet. Give me an idea of what that means.
I do. So there's lots of ways to study what our ancestors ate. I'm particularly interested in when meat eating came into our diet and how that really expanded. And so I look at animal fossils from archaeological sites, and I'm looking specifically for butchery marks made by stone tools, which are the smoking guns that let us know that early humans butchered and ate those animals.
All right. And you're not the first person to do this research. What do we know about when humans first started eating meat?
So we know, and actually recent research shows that early humans first started eating meat almost 3.5 million years ago. So there are butchery marks from early human sites that go back about that time. So that's pretty far back in our evolutionary history.
And what does that mean to us to know that?
Well, it gives us a sense of how our diet was expanding and diversifying. And there are certainly implications for our earliest ancestors eating meat. I mean, they were maybe 3 feet tall, did not have hunting technology, really came into contact then with larger carnivores and were competing with them for these carcasses of big animals.
Okay, so they weren't necessarily killing the animals themselves? Is that what you're saying?
Probably not. So there's an idea that scavenging was the way that our earliest ancestors who were meat eaters probably actually got a lot of the meat that they ate.
All right. And at that point, I mean, we know quite a lot about meat eating in chimpanzees, for example. And we know that in chimpanzees' diet, meat may make up about 2% of the diet. How essential was meat in the diet of early humans once they started incorporating it?
So that's kind of the million-dollar question. We can look at the frequency of sites that have butchery marks. We can look at the kinds of animals that have butchery marks, but it's still hard to know how important it was. It certainly seems to have become a lot more widespread by about 2 million or 1.5 million years ago. And we can see some milestones like at about 2 million years ago, we see early humans bringing carcasses to a place to butcher them over and over again. So that's a sense that it's becoming a little more important, as opposed to just, you know, maybe eating an animal here or there.
Now, in that early meat eating, what do we know about how the meat was eaten? Of course, when we think about meat eating today, we cook it. So
right.
When did we start doing that, or do we know?
We actually have evidence dating back to about 1 million years ago. The earliest evidence for cooking comes from a site called Wonderwerk Cave in South Africa. And then a little less than that, about 800,000 years ago, there's a site in Israel where we see repeated hearths, essentially, where people were going back to the same place over and over again to cook. But that's, you know, 2.5 million years of eating meat without cooking it. So it's possible people cooked meat earlier. We just don't have the evidence for it.
Now, why focus so much on this? Why is meat eating pivotal in our evolution, do you feel?
Well, it's certainly, you know, you are what you eat. And so anything that organisms eat are a really important part of their diet. It's part of our ecology, where we were on the landscape, what kinds of habitats we were preferring. It had major implications for our technology. We see the earliest origins of stone technology right around that time. And also there's an idea that it was eating more meat that actually facilitated brain growth and the evolution of the enormous brains that we have today. Meat's a really good source of fat and calories and protein. And so having a really concentrated source of food like that may have actually allowed and facilitated our brain growth.
Now, there are other things that go along with meat eating, and we did a program recently about the origins of agriculture. We've learned a lot about different origins of agriculture just in recent years because of the archaeological record. But as meat eating developed, then agriculture goes hand in hand with that. Is that part of your research to look at when we first started trying to manage livestock?
That's a lot more recent than what I focus on. But, I mean, that, in a sense, was the third major change in our diet that had to do with meat eating. The first is just starting to eat more meat. The second is cooking. And the third is really domestication of animals. And that has transformed the face of the planet.
Well, and does the introduction of dairy, does that go along with the domestication of animals? Or is that something that appeared before then?
Well, presumably it does. And so we certainly see animals that we think are kept for meat and or dairy. And actually, the evolution of lactose tolerance for people on the planet that can digest lactose and milk sugar, that really went hand in hand with domesticating dairy animals and is one of the best examples of recent evolution in humans.
All right. Now, I know we could talk about this for a long time, but that term paleo diet gets thrown around all the time these days. When you hear people talk about the paleo diet in pop culture today, you know a lot more about what it really was. What are some of the most important things that we should know about the real paleo diet?
So I would say that the real paleo diet, from all kinds of evidence, from chimpanzees to modern hunter-gatherers, was incredibly varied. There were seasonal differences, there were local differences, and so I think the paleo diet movement, which is often about excluding foods, that is not something I think our ancestors ever would have done. I joked that the paleo diet, I eat the paleo diet, I eat anything that I can get my hands on. So I think in a sense, you know, it's really hard to recreate our ancestral diet, and I'm not sure we would really even want to.
Now, before I let you go, we've been talking a lot about science education this hour. I know that that's also something that is very important to you, and you've worked on a project to provide teachers and students with better materials. What do you feel needs to be in the hands of teachers so they can teach evolution more effectively?
So I think it really is. It's updated materials. It's also one of the things that we've created with this project are basically techniques that teachers can use to introduce evolution to classrooms. Human evolution is a wonderful example of evolutionary processes, but also ways to make the classroom a comfortable place to learn evolution for students who may have some difficulty with it.
And we were talking earlier about how when teachers are teaching five different subjects, they may not have that much expertise in evolution themselves. Is that a big challenge that you see?
I do think that's a big challenge. And also, I mean, our knowledge base is increasing exponentially, which is really exciting. But I think, again, as we've talked about, having really good, up-to-date, easy-to-use resources specifically designed for classrooms is really important.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Brianna.
Thank you.
Brianna Pobner is an evolutionary anthropologist. She works with the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. She will be participating in Darwin Day at Iowa City on the 19th. She'll be giving a talk at 3 p.m. called Humans Are Still Evolving, Evidence from Diet, Disease, and Diversity. And then on the 20th, at 9:45 a.m., she'll be talking about the real paleo diet. And my next guest will also be a part of Darwin Day. He's an associate professor of anthropology at UC Davis. Tim Weaver is here. He'll be giving a couple of different talks as well, one called The Meaning of Neanderthal Skeletal Morphology and also The Importance of History and Chance in Human Evolution. Hello, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And it sounds like one of your talks is going to be a little more geared toward scientists themselves, and one is going to be a little more geared toward the general public. So let's focus on that a little bit. The importance of history and chance in human evolution. What do you feel is important for us to know about that?
Well, so I think one of the things that we've learned kind of recently studying human evolution is that the history of our own sort of kind of the groups, our closely related human groups, is much more like a branch than much more kind of a bushy kind of history than it is sort of a ladder-like history. And so that there were, you know, lots of different lineages at any given time, and the situation that we have today where we only have one, you know, species of human is you know, somewhat unique. And so thinking about this kind of branching process, and of course when you have a branching process, then kind of history matters. History and also chance events matter in terms of producing the kind of the different outcomes that we see either in our own lineage or in kind of closely related lineages like the Neanderthals, which I've spent a lot of time studying.
Now, I mentioned earlier how when we try to teach kids about evolution, it's really easy to simplify it, and then they come away with a very simple idea of what it is that may not be accurate. It sounds like this is making it even more complicated.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's that may be true. I mean, oftentimes I think in the popular, kind of a popular view of evolution, we think of it as sort of more of this ladder-like process, and you have this progression of species, you know, one species at any given time, and then they're getting kind of more and more human-like as you go through time. And so this is, I think, often the way we kind of talk about it, but I think that's really a misconception about evolution. And even going back to Charles Darwin, one of the things I want to talk about in my talk is Charles Darwin is one of the first to really talk about the kind of this branching process underlying evolution, and really thinking about the different species as kind of having their own unique evolutionary history, and it's not kind of a progression, you know, increasing complexity going towards humans. And so, yes, it may, in some sense, it may make it more complicated, but I think it's important to kind of understand this, that evolution is not sort of goal-oriented, and you know, we're not sort of the pinnacle of evolution, and you don't have a progression of species in the past that are all sort of leading towards us. I think that's an important point that we need to be teaching students.
I want to bring Dave from Dubuque into the conversation now with a question that you may have some insight on, Tim. Hello, Dave.
Sure.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, not so much a question as an observation, and that is, you know, we're the dominant species on the planet, and we have reached relative saturation of the planet, yet we don't obey evolution. It's not like a law that we must obey. Elephants aren't poorly evolved because they have ivory that we like, yet for years we've slaughtered them and shipped it around the world. When we hunt for the strongest animal. Could care less about the weak, limping deer. Maybe if we're starving, but we're not. We have managed the evolution of just such a wide variety of animals, intentionally and unintentionally, and we are not obeying evolution. So to preach it as a law of science is flat crazy. In my view, it is a simple tool in the toolbox of a creator. And to ignore the fact the dominant species is ignoring this supposed law of science ignore that and look back in time, and everything in evolution is always backwards. What about now?
Okay. Okay, Dave, I want to give Tim an opportunity to respond to that. And I think Dave's initial question is a little different from where he was going with that. But let's take that on. I mean, humanity has really changed evolution within our own species. We don't subject ourselves to a lot of the natural pressures that led us to where we are today. Is that something that, and we may be interfering with the evolution of other species as well, and we've of course domesticated species and definitely changed their evolutionary path. Is that something that researchers and teachers need to take into account, Tim?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a good point that we've certainly changed the evolutionary pressures of a number of species by, you know, modifying the environments. We've also changed, you know, the evolutionary pressures on our own species because of various cultural practices. And I think one of the caller's sort of question gets back to an issue that often comes up is, are humans still evolving? Are we still subject to kind of evolutionary pressures? And we have a number of kind of recent examples of evolution acting, you know, on humans. One of them has to do with, say, lactose tolerance, and it's related to cultural practices of domesticating of species and then retaining the ability into adulthood to be able to drink their milk, the milk of these species that we've domesticated. And we can see clear evidence of kind of natural selection acting on our genome, the genomes of people who have ancestry, you know, who have ancestors domesticated, you know, livestock. And so I think it's true that the pressures have changed, you know, the evolutionary pressures, the way that natural selection is acting has changed, but certainly we're still evolving. We're still subject to these same principles that that other species are subject to and that we've been subject to throughout our evolutionary history.
Now, before we run out of time and we only have a minute or so left, but I want to talk a little bit about the Neanderthal skeletal morphology. That's the topic of one of your talks. And one of the things that you're doing is you're actually looking at human anatomy, Neanderthal anatomy, and trying to understand why our bodies look the way that they look and work the way that they work. What are you looking at?
Well, so we've known about Neanderthals for, you know, more than 150 years, and they're, you know, they're the most closely related species perhaps that ever lived to humans. And so looking at comparing humans to Neanderthals is fascinating in that region because, you know, you can think about comparing humans to chimpanzees, the most closely related species that are living today, but we're much more closely related to Neanderthals. And, you know, ever since they were discovered, people have been fascinated about, you know, features of their anatomy, like why do they have such sort of, to in our perception, a very strangely shaped, you know, heads or strangely sort of shaped, you know, bodies. And so I've done a lot of research to try to understand, you know, why, how these differences arose and to try and understand, you know, how the different evolutionary histories of, you know, the Neanderthal lineage and our own lineage have produced these different features.
Which also returns to sort of that history and chance, because we'd like to believe there's a reason for everything about our bodies, right?
Yes. I mean, on some level, there is a reason for, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you know, all of the differences that we see between Neanderthals and modern humans are you know, for a reason, in the sense that, you know, they've been shaped by sort of different natural selective pressures. So one of the things that I've argued with some of my research is that some of the differences that we see between Neanderthals and modern humans in terms of our skulls may just be due to chance, the chance changes that happen in the different populations of Neanderthals and modern humans. And so over time, you end up getting kind of a different, slightly different shaped skull in these two different lineages. And
Tim,
not necessarily a reason for
right.
that.
Tim, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me on the show.
Tim Weaver is an associate professor of anthropology at UC Davis. He'll be participating in Darwin Day in Iowa City. You can find out more at iowacitydarwinday.org.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the time.